It was 40 years ago in 1977 when Robert Ballard and a team of oceanographers from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution made an incredible discovery, deep-sea hydrothermal vents. Joining us by phone from his office at the University of Rhode Island to look back at that discovery and how it has changed our understanding of life on Earth and beyond is Robert Ballard. Welcome to the program.
Well, good morning. What a beautiful day in New England,
it
huh?
It sure is. So before we discuss the discovery of the vents, can you explain what deep-sea hydrothermal vents are and where we find them?
Well, deep-sea hydrothermal vents are related to what's a giant mountain range, at least the one that we discovered, called the Mid-Ocean Ridge. It's the largest mountain range on Earth. It runs around the planet like the seam on a baseball, and it covers almost 23% of the Earth's total surface area. So it's a massive mountain range. But it's where the Earth creates its outer skin. All along the axis of this great mountain range, crustal plates of the planet are moving apart. And the Earth responds to that tear, really ripping open its outer skin like a creature, because I think of the Earth as a living creature, bleeds its blood. Now, its blood is a little hotter than ours. It's molten blood with a temperature of 1,200 to 1,400 degrees centigrade. And that blood resides in magma chambers and then periodically, as the plates move apart, opens up and lava flows out. Now, no sooner is that new crust formed, that new skin of the Earth is being created, it's being pulled apart again. And so deep cracks develop in this newly formed skin, letting water get down to near the magma chamber. So the water goes down those cracks and interacts with the heat and the chemistry of the magma chamber about a kilometer down. Mm. And then that hot, now altered water, called hydrothermal fluid, flows back up to the surface. And so we knew something funny was going on along the Mid-Ocean Ridge, and we suspected there were springs, hot water springs, caused by this process, but we never in our wildest imagination envisioned the consequences of that. We thought when we went out there that we were going to go along the Mid-Ocean Ridge with our vehicles. We had a search vehicle called Angus, and we were going to photograph and see cracks. And we were going to see water coming out of the cracks, and then we were going to send Alvin down to sample the water. Well, we found much more than that.
Yeah. So what was the mood on the ship when this discovery was made and when the first samples came up?
Dumbfounding. I mean, it was basically scientists don't like to look stupid. And so scientists will talk and talk and talk. But when something like that happens, they just stop talking.
So it's
this silence, and everyone's looking at one another going, you know, shrugging their – trying to understand what they were looking at, because it didn't make sense. Because we were told that all life on Earth was due to photosynthesis, that the sun was sending off these little bundles of energy called photons, and they were traveling at the speed of light through outer space and came into our atmosphere and were being captured by plants, captured like a catcher's glove, capturing that photon of energy and then using it to fix carbon. And then you had plants, and then animals ate the plants, and up the food chain you went. So that's what we had read in our biology books. And so when we came to a world that we expected to be barren, see, not totally barren, but more like a desert, a life here, a life there, because there's no sunlight down there. We were down at 8,000-9,000 feet, so there was no sunlight. And it was brand new terrain. It was like going to Mars. It was beautiful volcanic terrain. Some of it, the lava was so fresh you had to almost wear sunglasses because it was so glassy and reflective in the lights of our submarine. And then all of a sudden we see these giant worms.
Right.
I mean, like, what are you doing here? It was like that movie, you know, Lost Continent, or some scientist went down in a volcano and there were dinosaurs. It was like, this doesn't make sense. And so when scientists get hit with it, they just sort of pause, and then they start to try to crack the nut and figure it out, which we did.
So was it clear pretty much right away that this was groundbreaking? That this was
absolutely.
Yeah, you're like, okay,
fact,
something's going on here.
The irony of it all, this is probably the greatest biological discovery ever made on Earth, and it was done by geologists, which sort of ticks the biologists off. And we had invited them along on the cruise. I don't want to go down there. There's a bunch of rocks. So they had turned us down. So I can remember when we found this hydrothermal vents with our remote cameras, and then sent Alvin down. We brought up one of these worms. I mean, this guy, it was like 8 feet long, okay? And I called, and we didn't have the modern technology we have today to do it live and let everyone watch it, which is what we do now. You can watch my vehicle's underwater right this second at nautiluslive.org. You can tune in, and they're exploring this second. We didn't have that technology back then. So we had a terrible radio, and I tried to call. I was calling back to Woods Hole. And I remember reaching Fred Grassley in the biology department. I said, "Fred, I want to. Something's crazy going on here. We just found these giant worms." He said, "You know, that's impossible." And I said, "No, I'm holding on to one of them." So it was just a really interesting. So I said, "What should I do with it?" He said, "Well, pickle it in formaldehyde." And I said, "Well, we don't have. We're geologists. We don't have any formaldehyde." He said, "Do you have any liquor?" Well, I was a chief scientist, you know, and it's supposed to be a dry ship. And I went around and I said, "All right, guys, I need your stash." And so we got the bourbon and vodka. We got everything we could get.
Oh, my goodness.
And they just made me promise not to pick up a lot of them. Because, you know, an 8-foot worm takes a lot of vodka.
I'll tell you a funny story. We had Tim Shank and Sonny Williams on talking about, you know, the various discoveries. And somebody asked Sonny, who many know is an astronaut, asked Sonny when she was up on the space station if she had ever seen any aliens. And she said, "No, but Tim sees them all the time."
Right. We see unbelievable crazy stuff all the time. And like I say, if you go to our website, right now we found some just crazy creatures, new species, and I must say, as a geologist, you know, it's really hard because you're always up against these biologists that have all these cool critters, you know. But you know, we get distracted by the critters once in a while.
Yeah, sure. So you mentioned the reaction from the scientists on shore. What was the media's reaction when you came back?
Well, we actually had a news writer on the trip, Perlman, from the San Francisco Chronicle, and he filed the stories, and they were extremely, I mean, it was like, you know, making this is one of the seminal discoveries, and so he was writing them daily, filing reports on it. So it was a very popular thing. We went back 2 years later. It took us 2 years to organize a return trip to bring some biologists. And we then did a National Geographic television special called Dive to the Edge of Creation, which was extremely successful, very popular.
So what are the respective roles of human-occupied vehicles and the ROVs in exploration in general, and how do they work hand-in-hand during the discovery?
Well, the Alvin, which I spent 20-some years diving in and helped pioneer, is really not an exploratory vehicle. You know, it's crawling around on your hands and knees in the dark with a flashlight. It doesn't move very slow. A baby crawls almost faster than Nautilus, and then Alvin moves along the bottom. So it's a very slow. It's the final punch. It's what you bring in after you've done all the prep work. So before we brought Alvin into play, we had to do a lot of prep. We had to, you know, first was to get the Navy, quite honestly, to use a super secret sonar system. I was in the Navy also at the same time, to go in and map, give us a map. I mean, explorers need maps. And so we got a beautifully high-resolution detailed map that showed us the rift, the floor. We could see exactly where the volcanoes were, and so it was very important to do that. Then you go in and ground truth that, and we had a camera system called Angus that we arrived ahead of Alvin. Lulu, we were towing Lulu from Panama, from Rodman at the Panama Canal out with the Nor, but then we broke off the tow and said, "We'll see you," and we steamed ahead, because Lulu can only go a few miles an hour. And so we steamed ahead to set up we had to put down bottom transponders and tracking systems and all that. And then we began hunting. And so we need a vehicle that, you know, can stay down and, you know, like the Argo, which we used to find Titanic. You want a vehicle that you put down, you don't bring it up. And the problem is with a manned vehicle or human-occupied vehicle, they go down, you got to come up. I mean, you know, they spend most of their time in an elevator going up and down. The average depth of the ocean is, you know, 12,000 feet. It's going to take you 2.5 hours to get to work in the morning, 2.5 hours to get home at night. Imagine a job that has a 5-hour commute. Mm-hmm. and you do it every day, you're not going to spend a lot of time at the office. When I dove to 20,000 feet, it was 6 hours each way. I was down there minutes before I got to go back up. Whereas with the robotic vehicles, like the one I built at Woods Hole, the Argo and the Jason ROV systems, which are premier vehicles there right now and being heavily used, you put them down and you leave them down and you don't come up. It's all about bottom time. To be an explorer, you want to be on the bottom.
Yeah, and certainly the technology over the last 40 years has
it's off the chart.
Crazy, right?
Yeah, it's not even fair. I mean, right now, I don't even have to go out there. I mean, I go out there for the heck of it. But the Nautilus, I went and acquired my own ship, the EV Nautilus, which is owned and operated by my trust, the Ocean Exploration Trust. And it's out at sea now for 6.5 months. And now we just rotate. So every time we come in to get some, you know, milk and some vegetables, we change out people. And so we're just touch and go. It's been touching and going since May. And it'll continue right up to just before Thanksgiving. It's just relentless.
Yeah.
And that's what it's all about. And eventually, quite honestly, everything will be robotic. I mean, you won't even – all the ships will be no people on them. I mean, humans – think about it. Humans, 95% of the human population only lives on 5% of Earth, and there's a reason. We've evolved ourselves into a box. You know, we're very intolerant of lots of things like freezing to death or being burnt or needing oxygen. We're sort of picky about what makes us happy, and it's only 5% of the earth where 95% of us are. So that's not going to, you know, I don't see us developing lungs anytime soon, or gills anytime soon. So I see us relying more and more upon what we call end effectors, which are robots. I mean, Avatar, a guy went in another creature, a Navi, so he left his body. And we're now, particularly as we get older and, you know, not as mobile, we're going to leave our body more. In fact, the next generation that are in schools right now, the ones that run around with those things in their ears, they look like us, but they're really a different human species. that's the future. The future is telepresence. The future is moving your spirit into some other end effector.
Sounds like science fiction.
No, I've been doing it now. It's not science fiction. It was science fiction. But it's real now.
Yeah. All right, so tell us how the discovery of the vents in 1977 changed the direction of research, and what were some of the immediate questions that remained?
Well, it just turned it turned everything upside down. All of a sudden, we were finding that life can thrive in extreme environments. See, when you look at, in chemistry, you have what's called the pH, 1 to 14, and 1 is very acidic, and 14 is very alkaline. Our body, it has a pH of right in the middle, like seawater, around 7.5. So we thought that you had to live in this very narrow zone, that life lived in this middle of it. And then when we found hydrothermal vents that were highly acidic, and then when we found Lost City, which highly alkaline, all of them had extremophiles, and all of a sudden we were realizing life can live in a lot of environments we thought was not livable. And so that just blew open the prospects of life off our planet. I'm confident, completely, totally confident, there's highly intelligent people throughout the universe, or things, not necessarily people, highly intelligent creatures throughout the universe. And I'm confident that there's life within our own solar system, but not highly intelligent. We're sort of trapped. The human race, because of the laws of physics, you can't exceed the speed of light or you reach infinite mass and your heart fails, okay? So we're not going to be traveling around to these people. We're not going to be able to reach them. So we've been quartered off by some process. You can go religious on that if you'd like. But anyway, we're stuck on this. Mars is not an option. We're stuck on this planet. But doesn't mean there isn't life all over the place, which I'm confident there is. I can't wait for NASA to go to Europa or Enceladus and find some bacteria and get it over. You know, let's get over it. Yes, there's life within our own solar system, but I don't want to go there.
Yeah. When you look at some of the new findings coming out of the deep sea vent research, what's the most surprising or exciting to you right now?
Well, again, the continued creativity of the living process. It's just amazing what it makes. You know, it takes the same rules, and everyone obeys the same rules, but it comes up with this spice of life. Variety is the spice of life. And that's what naturally we worry about as we go through massive extinctions, because humans are crowding everyone out.
When you discover, like, the worms, the worms are not the only life that you've discovered, but as you discover these things, you can take your photos and stuff, but you actually have to have the creature piece of it, to document, right?
Yeah.
What's that process?
Well, it depends. Some of the creatures are easy. Pick up a clam is pretty easy. Pick up a delicate invertebrate, you can totally destroy it. Mm. So it becomes a question of, sampling techniques and how careful you are. But we've cracked that. We now have on our vehicle Hercules, we have a rosette that's almost like a miniature aquarium, and we have a very delicate suction device, and so we can suck up very, very fragile things and bring them up into this little aquarium and then close the door on them, and they're fine. So it's a question that we've certainly done it with picking up ancient antiquity and artifacts that we might, that we don't want to break or damage. So we've got really good at that. Now they've got new systems where the manipulators are really almost like a human hand, very compliant, and can go pick up very delicate things. So we sort of cracked that.
Yeah, that's amazing. One last question, Bob. You spend so much time, exploring the sea, and certainly it's changed over the many years you've been out there. What are your thoughts about what's happening in the ocean and your biggest concern?
Well, my biggest concern is we need to move away from a hunter-gatherer society out there. We're, 11,000 years ago, the human race said, hey, why don't we domesticate a sheep or a goat? Why don't we cultivate corn or wheat? Why don't we move away from a hunter-gatherer society to farming and herding? And as a result, we developed the city-state. All of a sudden, you'd have to run around, sit next to a tree, and wait for it to make fruit. You could actually have a fruit orchard. So we need to move away from capturing the animals in the ocean that are the lions and tigers and bears. We're eating the top predators of the ocean. I mean, imagine if you went to the supermarket and they were selling tiger meat. There wouldn't be many tigers. And so what we're doing is we've now, because of that hunter-gatherer process in the open ocean, we've eaten and destroyed 90% of all the big creatures. So this is because we're eating at the top part of the trophic level of the food chain. Salmon. I mean, that's crazy. Mm-hmm. Okay, you want to be eating something that is straight photosynthesis conversion. And, if you look at sheep and goats and the animals we eat on land, they eat grass, or they're herbivores. And so the key is to convert, and there's a great program called the Villela Project, where they took a carnivore fish, a kampachi. So you buy it, you have it at a sushi restaurant, it's called hamachi. And they've converted it to a herbivore, and they've fundamentally domesticated by putting it in cages and feeding it soybean. And now algae, so that they've been able to bring it down to the trophic level of efficiency. And so we need to get more and more into not worrying about sustaining the ocean's productivity, but greatly increasing its productivity.
Hmm. Bob Ballard will be giving a talk about the discovery of deep sea vents this weekend in Woods Hole, but it is sold out. But Hui is also hosting a symposium on recent discoveries at these vent sites starting this Sunday. So we'll have links for more information about the symposium at our website, capeandislands.org. Bob Ballard, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Can't wait to get back to Hui.
We have an email from Bruce Strickbot, manager and senior pilot of Alvin at Hui, and I want to read this for you. He says, Dr. Ballard's comments disparaging Alvin as an obsolete tool that crawls no faster than a baby is inherently wrong. The new Alvin is state-of-the-art in all aspects and is no way the same vehicle he used in the 1970s. I would recommend that a fair description of the new manned vehicle be included in the story. Alvin's abilities through the decades have led to numerous important discoveries, and the new vehicle provides significant capabilities that will continue to provide service to scientists into the future. Also, there are no remote cameras currently that can provide the same experience as a front row seat to extreme environments. The human eye and the spatial experience obtained in Alvin cannot be matched by video screens. I have taken many observers on dives that have visited the deep environments with remote systems, and after their dive in the Alvin, they unanimously state, I never knew it would look like that. All have used their unique experiences in Alvin to better their understanding of the Earth's extreme environments. And although unmanned vehicles play a key role in the big picture of access to the deep sea, manned vehicles provide a unique and important access for humans to visit the deep sea that is unmatched by any remote system. Bruce Strickard, thanks for writing that in and sharing your thoughts with us. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.